April is National Bilingual and Multilingual Learner Advocacy Month. That's why we're so excited to tell you about a new special series from Science of Reading, the podcast, that will launch later this month. Over several episodes, we'll talk to leading researchers and practitioners about how the science of reading serves multilingual and English learners, and how to best use the science of reading to support those students in the classroom. That's all starting at the end of this month. Stay tuned to this feed for more.
What if a change in classroom practice could lead to change in reading outcomes? What should reading instruction include to ensure all students have the opportunity to succeed? What does cognitive science tell us about learning to read, and why aren't those learnings applied in our classrooms? Welcome to Science of Reading, the podcast. I'm your host, Susan Lambert from Amplify Education. Join us every 2 weeks as we talk with science of reading experts to explore what it takes to transform our classrooms and develop confident and capable readers. As districts and schools are quickly responding to the COVID-19 school closures, we thought it would be important to talk with David Steiner, director of the Johns Hopkins Institute for Educational Policy and professor of education at Johns Hopkins University. In our conversation, we talk about how districts and schools are responding, challenges of remote learning, and how the federal government has recently responded. Good morning, David. Thank you so much for joining us on today's special episode.
It's my pleasure.
So before we get going, I'd love to ask you to talk to our listeners a bit about what your current role is and a little bit about your past work. I can't imagine that folks maybe don't know who you are, but maybe they don't. So why don't you start by sharing that?
Of course, I'll make it brief. I am currently the executive director of the Johns Hopkins Institute for Education Policy. We are in our fifth year of work here at Johns Hopkins University. We work with state education leaders, district leaders, nonprofits, think tanks, mayor's offices across the country on issues of education policy. We make research-based recommendations. We create tools to improve student learning outcomes. Before being here at Hopkins, I served as Commissioner of Education for New York State during the Race to the Top period, and had the privilege of launching the funding for Engage New York. Engage New York was the first free online source of high quality curriculum, and has, I think, spawned a whole industry, if you can put it that way, of new materials, of high quality materials. And I think that that's been a very important development. I had the privilege prior to that of serving as dean of a very large school of education in New York City and directing education at the National Endowment for the Arts.
So you're in a really unique position to talk to us then about what's happening right now in terms of educational response to COVID-19 and sort of this unique situation we've found ourselves in. I'd just like to start by asking you, in relation to what we're having to deal with now, you know, so many schools, or most schools that are out and kids at home, what do we know and what don't we know in the current situation?
Well, it is a difficult situation for everybody. And the honest answer is that we are, by necessity, somewhat making this up as we go along.
Yeah.
If you look across the country, there are thousands of different responses from thousands of different districts as they think about their own capacity, as they think about the demographics of the children and families that they're working with. For many, this has been a scramble. They have not traditionally used online materials, and it's not a simple business. You can't simply click a switch and shift everything from face-to-face to online. There are serious challenges which we can talk about. I think everyone is trying, and understandably and rightly, the very first focus has been on nutrition for underprivileged children, making sure that meal, which tragically is one that many, many, many children depend on for their only really strong, nutritious meal of the day is available and provided. That has to be the first priority. Now, I think many districts are turning to the question of how they are going to teach their students.
That does make a lot of sense. And many districts I've seen too, like you, have, you know, highlighted the holistic response to students, which is just really encouraging.
Yes.
As it relates, though, to the education of their students, what are you hearing from either state level responses or what it means for districts specifically?
I think, again, there's a range. I mean, let's imagine right now one end of the spectrum. Imagine that your students are logging in daily to a video conferencing system using something like Google Classroom to access assignments and content, that every 40 or 50 minutes they see a new teacher leading a new lesson in real time, providing input. Those students are able to collaborate across classrooms and grades, they get connected with their teachers and advisors every day. They have online faculty office hours. And to support all of this online work, the parents and children receive daily and weekly lesson plans that lay out the assignments, the video selections, and supporting materials, including, let's say, ebooks and audio content for young pre-readers. Now, what I've just described is actually not a fantasy. It's what Success Academies, a group of charter schools in New York, are making available for their thousands of students. But that depends on enormous amounts of planning. It depends on the students having access to tablets. It depends on a very highly detailed set of plans for instruction, a great deal of resources, practice, and leadership from the top of the organization. At the other end, you have large districts with the best will in the world who are struggling. New York City, which has to educate over 1 million students of every conceivable background, is trying and is trying to equip students with devices, remote learning devices. There's a website where families can sign up, and obviously the students most in need are expected to get those devices disproportionately, as they should. There is a website called Learn at Home, which has some packets of activity and digital learning tools, but there's as yet, quite understandably, no real effort to organize learning by grade or by subject, still less, of course, by individual classrooms. That is a huge undertaking. If one looks at Los Angeles, which is, you know, one of the other very large districts, they are trying to send out lessons and homework assignments via the internet. But again, many of the students don't have access to computers or tablets. And for them, the district has actually made an agreement with PBS so that those children can watch TV, and PBS is linked to the district with coordinated assignments so that the children watch the program and then do some associated work. But even there, it's patchy. The newspapers report that some students are really just working on a few worksheets. So for very large districts and for districts with underprivileged students, this is a real challenge.
Yeah. What might that mean for small districts or really rural districts? Have you heard anything about how they're coping with this?
Yeah, again, it depends very much on the demographics, right? So if you look at one of the very first, if not the first district to face this challenge, North Shore, which is a relatively affluent Washington State district, they've been distributing laptops and setting up Wi-Fi hotspots so that in their case, you know, a middle school arts teacher can live stream a drawing class using paper and pencil that students have at home. Kindergarten teachers can read a story aloud on video and then upload it onto the website for students. But even there, in a district that was well organized, that really was one of the first because of Washington State's very high coronavirus infection rate to actually have to do this, there were so many problems and challenges with special needs students that in the end, the district put a pause on the whole thing. They just hit the pause button on any teaching. We can come back to what the federal government is advising districts in terms of reaching those special needs students later. But it is an important story in sort of saying here was a district that was well organized and then hit a major roadblock. And again, I think in the case of many rural districts, it all depends, right? What kind of access do its students have? I mean, let's again be real world. Let's imagine that you have three children at home. They're at two different schools. Let's say that the school is very organized and has a lot of sequenced materials. But if you have one computer and three children, they can't all be doing lessons right at the same time. And so if you speak to a number of school districts, what they have started with, and again, this is very rational and very sane, they've started with reading packets, right? They've been distributing hard copy materials, basically, to students, to families. And there, the challenge, of course, is that this is largely unstructured work. And some students have parents who are able to help them at home. Some don't. Some parents, despite the current situation, must go to work.
Yeah,
they have no choice. And if you're a child, you know, with other children at home, maybe there's an older sibling looking after you. You're staring at this sort of reading packet of materials, not so easy to motivate or structure learning.
Yeah, and that's certainly not explicit instruction like we need for the youngest ones.
That's right. That's
So what about some of the, we've talked a little bit about some of the challenges. What about some of the unintended consequences that are starting to emerge and what's being surfaced?
So the biggest problem here, and let's be very frank about it, is that we went into this crisis with a tragic learning gap, largely between students who are underprivileged economically and those who are not. Most experts that we are talking to and our own research suggests, sadly, that unless we are incredibly well organized about this very quickly, those learning gaps will widen. So if you think about it for a moment, it's not very complicated to figure out why. If you are privileged or more privileged child, your family probably has multiple computers, certainly a number of tablets, can quickly buy more if they need it. Your more affluent district with its suburban school or its high quality urban public school is going to make an assumption that the online access is there, that the access to reasonably high speed internet is available, that every child has access to a device, and can quite rapidly shift to an online teaching environment. In a place like the one I live in Baltimore, where Johns Hopkins University is located, that's fantasy land, right? Thousands and thousands of children do not have access to anything more than, you know, a smartphone. And it's very naive to think that you can treat a smartphone the same way as you can treat a tablet. And even there may not be smartphones and certainly aren't in every family, let alone computers at home. So again, the access to instruction is going to be inequitable. And of course, the experience of teachers is inequitable. Many teachers teaching in more affluent districts have already had experience with mixed modality learning. They may have done work online with children, whereas teachers who are teaching in a city like Baltimore or Newark or St. Louis or Detroit, you know, are much less likely to have that experience themselves. So this is a fundamental national challenge, and there are no easy answers.
Yeah. As an extension of that, I'm wondering what you're thinking about, like, next year at this time when this is over and we're looking back on now. Yes. Obviously, we've talked about some of the concerns we have in terms of equitable learning, increasing the learning gap. What would you say would be maybe some positive things that might we could look back on this and say, oh, well, that was a positive unintended consequence?
Yes. I mean, I think the optimistic view here is that many thousands of teachers and potentially millions of children will discover that well-used online teaching can, in fact, be a big plus. As teachers get to work with internet resources, and a number of folks are putting out materials for free, we can come back to that, they will be investigating new ways of teaching, and students will be experiencing new ways of learning. And probably once this sort of secret is out, as it were, because it must be, that is, teachers will have no choice but to try to teach with online materials as much as they can, as much as their districts encourage them to, they will surely find that there are very, very positive aspects to doing so. And I would expect that one of the positives that we will pull out of this is that teachers will become very thoughtful about integrating online teaching into different areas of their work.
Yeah, and you're right. It certainly is that people in education and people outside of education are sort of really rallying together to at least ensure students have something out there to look at to potentially learn.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, just to mention one, and we have worked with them in the past, but there's no financial interest here at all. The Schusterman Foundation, which supports multiple educational enterprises, obviously a nonprofit foundation, has put on its website a whole series of resources. Many of the high quality curriculum publishers have put out material for free. Those include some that are all green lighted on EdReports, for some of your listeners who may not know about that. EdReports is another nonprofit that evaluates curriculum for standards alignment and quality. And many of its top graded curriculum in math and ELA are now out for free. I'll give you some examples. Zurn, which is a very highly rated math curriculum, has over 400 hours of digital lessons.
Wow.
With on-screen teachers and remediation support. for free and has webinars to support teachers who are using it. A Core Knowledge and Disclosure, I'm on their board, has a free downloadable curriculum. Obviously, Amplify is working with Core Knowledge there. And those curriculum include language arts, history, geography, and science. Obviously, many districts already use those materials, so that's a natural for moving from a classroom, regular classroom environment to an online environment using that free material. For other districts that may not have used that material, it's an opportunity to see what high quality instructional materials look like and maybe to use them. That is also potentially a great positive to come out of this. But I don't want to be Pollyanna-ish. If you haven't worked with a curriculum before, suddenly doing so, particularly in a new environment, namely online, isn't going to be simple. It's going to take time.
Yeah, I was talking with one of my friends who is both a former teacher, classroom teacher, and a parent trying to navigate this environment now. And she mentioned it's great that there's so many resources out there. Now she feels like there's too many because it's really been difficult to try to curate some of those.
No, that's right. And that's why I mentioned these high quality curricula.
Yeah.
I think it depends so much on the school. If the school is really unable to provide more than, you know, a worksheet or two, then parents may go to these materials online. And for example, with ELA, they can find perhaps a unit around a text that their child has already looked at or begun to read, right? And try to build from where the child is rather than just plunging them into completely unknown territory. Same with math. I mean, the advice we would give to teachers and parents is actually the same. As you shift to the online environment, start with material that's relatively familiar, so that families and children can become comfortable, right, with the online environment, and then move forward sequentially using one of these strong curricula. Mm.
That's great advice. Great advice. As we think about our federal government's response and how they're supporting states and potentially district, what's happening on that front?
So the major challenge here, it may sound a little technical, but I assure you it's important, is that a number of districts across the country, including large ones like Philadelphia, initially simply didn't offer any teaching online, not because they didn't want to, but because they were afraid of contravening the IDEA Act, the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, which basically says that you have to be able to, if you are going to teach, you have public school students, you have to teach them all, including those who have special needs. And they were worried, understandably, that many children with special needs are not going to be able to access in any easy way or at all the online formatted instructional materials we've been talking about, right? Many of these children depend on human-to-human interaction, which, of course, can't happen under the current coronavirus. So what's happened is USDOE has now issued what they call a supplemental fact sheet. This was on March 21st, where they say explicitly, and I'll quote, "Some educators have been reluctant to provide any distance instruction because they believe that federal disability law presents insurmountable barriers to remote education. This is simply not true. We remind schools that they should not opt to close or decline to provide distance instruction at the expense of students to address matters pertaining to services for students with disabilities," close quote. Now, that's extremely important. It should reassure districts that while they absolutely should make a best faith effort to teach all of their students. And while as USDOE, the United States Department of Education, emphasizes in their fact sheet, this may fall short of the level of instruction that used to be available to those special needs children and therefore require remediation later, a good faith effort has to be good enough. I mean, the ethics here is clear. Just because you cannot, unfortunately, reach every child to the same degree is not a reason to teach none of them. And that's extremely important.
Yeah.
So that's been the guidance as of March 21st.
That's interesting. That's hot off the press then as of this weekend.
Yeah.
And we'll be sure to link our listeners in the show notes to that to that fact sheet for sure. It's just it's a new ground we're breaking here, right? Like every day I wake up and I don't even have school age children of my own, although I have grandchildren that are school aged, and just wonder long term what this impact is going to be like for all of our children here in the United States and the world, really.
It is a very difficult moment. And as I say, the deepest problem is the digital divide is really coming home to roost. That is, those who have and those who don't have tablets and computers for children at home and Wi-Fi and all the rest.
Yeah.
This is, you know, I think, again, going to your point about best case outcomes will be a wake-up call to districts to really see that inequality cannot persist, at least that digital inequality. As I say, New York is trying to remedy it. I know that a number of major foundations are working with industry to try to ramp up the production of inexpensive tablets. Part of this, of course, depends on how long this lasts, right? If we're looking at a few weeks, that's one thing. We can remediate to some degree for a few weeks. It won't be perfect, but it won't be a tragic opening of the gap. If we're talking the rest of the school year, that's a long time. And that is going to take enormous work in the summer and in the fall to remediate, assuming that, you know, we're even able to get back to it during the summer. I mean, districts may have to think about summer learning in new ways and remediation in new ways.
Yeah. And there's even some talk of, are we even going to be thinking about opening schools for back to school 2020?
Yes, I mean, you know, we none of us know that we'll have to just see. I mean, I think the optimistic view is that this will peak in the next few weeks, at least in the next month or two, and then begin to decline. Let's keep our fingers crossed.
Yeah, for sure. Well, we do appreciate you jumping on with us really quickly, telling us sort of the lay of the land. And as we close, I'd love for you to sort of give your advice for leaders or practitioners at this time. What, you know, what do you think their highest priority is for them to be thinking about or helping their teachers with?
Yes, I think the first is don't make the ideal the enemy of the possible, right? You know, knowing that not every child had access to online, many don't, Baltimore public schools under the terrific leadership of Sonia Santelices didn't say no online learning. They said, we will do the very best we can. We're going to put some stuff together, materials together for online learning. We're also going to distribute those materials physically for students who don't have them, even knowing that there may be differential learning as a result, right? Not everyone is going to benefit in the same way from the same resources. That's a fact of life. And I think we just have to be grown up about this and work as hard as we can to minimize those differences. That means getting in touch with foundations, seeking support to get, you know, certain minimally adequate tablets into the most children's hands who need them as quickly as possible, while you work with your teachers to think about how to do the best they can, right? So start with the possible and build. Don't be the deer in headlights that says, well, we can't do anything because we can't do everything. Start gradually, build it up, and take a sense of what's out there. Be willing to experiment. Try and use the high quality online free materials where you can. Figure out where you need to use physical printing for students who don't have access, and build gradually. Don't try to do everything tomorrow.
Really good advice. And we just thank you again, David, for taking your time and especially for the work that you do every day for our districts and schools.
Well, our thoughts really are with the district leaders who are on the front line, with the teachers, with the parents, and with the children. We will get through this, but we have an enormous amount of work to do. So let's all work together and see how we can really maximize the opportunities for our worst off students.
Absolutely. Thank you, David.
Thank you so much.
We're so grateful to our amazing guest today and to all of you making a difference in the lives of students every single day. Be sure to check the show notes for resource links from today's podcast, and we want to hear your stories and successes. Follow us on Facebook at Science of Reading the Community, or if you're looking to help implement the science of reading, send an email to sormatters@amplify.com. Tell us what guests you think we should book, or tell us about the research that really excites you. And be sure to hit the subscribe button on your favorite podcast app so you don't miss an episode. Until next time, I'm Susan Lambert.